Okay, so over the last 2 weeks, we've been looking at the subject of money and wealth within the book of Proverbs. And before we dive in, though, to looking at more of the principles today, I want to read you something from a pastor named Kevin DeYoung, who wrote for an organization called the Gospel Coalition. And I appreciate what he said in light of everything we've been learning so far. And the article was long, so I've paraphrased it and added my own little words here and there to make it smooth. But the majority comes from Kevin, and I want to read this to you. We all know that the Bible speaks a lot about money and wealth. We are grateful for it, but there's an opposite problem. Because the Bible says so much about money, it's easy to develop an imbalanced theology of it. On the one hand, it's easy to see where the prosperity theology comes from. Take a few promises of the Mosaic Covenant out of their context. Take the promise of Malachi 3 about throwing open the storehouses of heaven. Mix in some of Jesus' statements about receiving whatever you ask for in faith, and you can bake up a little health and wealth gospel. You could make a biblical argument that God really approves rich guys. You look at Abraham, you look at Job, you look at Zacchaeus, and look at the way he blesses obedient kings. On the other hand, it's possible to be imbalanced on the other side. Point out that Jesus had nowhere to lay his head. You could turn to the story of the rich young ruler, stir in the parable of the rich fool, and you'll have a theology that says money is bad and so are those who have it. You can even make the biblical argument that God disapproves of rich guys. Just look at the rich man in Lazarus. Look at the book of James. Look at Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount. So how should we think of money and possessions? Well, Proverbs is a good place to begin. For starters, there's a lot of verses on the subject. More important, there are several diverse strands of teaching on the subject, and Proverbs looks at health and poverty from several angles. And because Proverbs is a book of general principles and not rules, Proverbs are more easily transferable to God's people at different times and places. So that's good. It's really good. And the best part is I didn't write it. That's why it's so good. But I love it, right? He's recapping the Proverbs. He's saying, why is it so applicable for us today? And so we're going to look at some principles this morning. But just to recap, in the first week on money and wealth, we talked about the dangers of money and why people even pursue it, and spoke about it's easy for us to fall into the same temptations, right? I mean, it's one thing to look at other people and say how they fall for that and why they pursue that, but we can go into the same vein. And so we remembered that it starts with our heart. None of these principles make sense unless our heart is soft before God and we're humble before Him. And the Proverbs describes that as fearing the Lord, right? Where you say, Lord, you're an authority in this area of life, and I'll bend to your will. It's not about me being an authority and what I want to do. Last week, then, we looked at the first principle out of that, and that was honoring the Lord with your wealth and what that actually meant. So this week, we're going to unpack some more principles within Proverbs. Now, some of you, this is going to be a review because you've heard this before, in discipleship meetings and different things. Also, because Roger did a great job, he spoke about a lot of these things last summer, if you were here, and so some of these things are repeat. But if you're anything like me, repetition is key. I often don't retain everything on my first hearing, and so it'll be good to hear it out again. So I want to show you on the PowerPoint this morning how we're going to approach this. Thanks to Aaliyah and her beautiful drawings, we've got Lady Wisdom on one side and Lady Folly. And again, Proverbs speaks of the wisdom of God as being Lady Wisdom and the Lady of Folly being the ways of the world, like the non-godly ways of looking at life. Okay? And so I've color-coded it for you today when we look at the Proverbs. So you're going to see all the wise statements from Proverbs and financial principles are in green, and all the foolish ones are in red. Sometimes the entire thing will be in red because it's all about being foolish. Sometimes it'll all be in green because it's all about being wise. And then sometimes there's a mixture of both. So for example, if I were to say the principle, don't be a gossip, Proverbs 13:11 would say, a gossip betrays a confidence, which is Lady Folly, but a trustworthy person keeps a secret, which is Lady Wisdom. So I want to explain the color coding so that when you're looking at my slides, you're not trying to figure out the entire sermon, what the heck's going on, and why they're in two different colors. We'll keep it pretty linear here. Okay, So with that being said, turn to Proverbs 12:11. The first principle we're going to learn, which is also on the PowerPoint, is that you're to pursue your primary income from work and not quick fix schemes. Proverbs 12:11. Oh, I put 28:19 on there. You know what? Keep 12:11 as well. It's the same thing. There's two places it occurs, 12:11 and 28:19. So he who tills his land will have plenty of food, but he who follows an empty pursuit will have poverty and plenty. This describes the person who is looking to gain their primary income from as little work as possible and as quickly as possible. So they're not looking to be diligent. It's not about hard work. It's not about commitment to the job. It's just trying to provide for oneself as quickly and as easily as possible instead of playing the long game. So examples of this are people that are quick to jump into multi-level marketing businesses where they want to get in early as possible to make as much money as possible. And we've had our friends that have done that, right? They come to us and go, by the way, I want to introduce you to this new product. And it's really not about the product at all. It's about that person getting as much money as quickly as possible. And so, and then that's why you meet them 6 months later and they've ditched the product because it didn't produce a financial gain. But the multi-level marketing systems make you think about the product as the ways of it try to entice people. But let's be honest, none of us would do them if it didn't have a financial promise of reward. Pyramid schemes are another way that this can happen. The high-risk stock market, you invest a ton of money trying to get a quicker return as possible. Lottery tickets, and my personal favorite that I'm tempted with, maybe like the 50-50 that happens at different sports events. And again, okay, so I want to share, though, just some practical examples of, people that have recognized that wealth comes from hard work and not necessarily from these quick fix schemes. Years ago, I wasn't a Christian then, but a guy, a client of mine, told me about this book called The Millionaire Mind. And it was about a guy who had sent out thousands upon surveys to millionaires across the United States. And his goal was to find out information about what kind of work they did, what were their hobbies, what kind of lifestyle did they live. And he compiled data from those who sent back the surveys and wrote a book about it. And it was super fascinating. Like, I learned so much about, you know, what we perceive as what people do versus what they really do. And hard work, hard work was the number one thing. All of these people had worked diligently at their jobs and had made like a real long effort in making this go. Now, and we often think that it's primarily through rich parents that have passed down money and so on and so forth, right? Or they just got lucky. But no, these people were hard workers. But what was the interesting thing was they talked about how many of these millionaires played the lottery, the quick fix scheme. And the answer was that hardly any of them did. Hardly any of them did. Now, here's the reason why. For a millionaire to make $1 million, so most millionaires are more than a million, but just to make $1 million, let's say you worked 40 hours a week for 48 weeks. So I gave you a month off of holidays a year. You would have to make $550 per hour to make $1 million. Now here's what the book said. Because a person just putting their head down and working for 1 hour could make $550, half an hour is $275. The time it takes you to get in your car, drive to the local convenience store, prepare all that, get your ticket, have small talk with the person working there, getting your car and back sometimes takes people half an hour to 45 minutes. And the millionaires recognize the amount of time they're going to spend playing lottery and trying to win the big payback would be far better spent at $550 an hour just putting their head down and working. But again, that's not what we often think. The lottery is portrayed as the way to financial freedom, but the millionaire mind was saying no. The millionaires in those books didn't actually really play the lottery at all. It didn't make sense. They knew to pursue their primary income from work and not quick fix schemes. Just so you know that I was on the side of Lady Folly a number of years ago, I'll tell you a personal story. In 1999, I had just moved to town. I didn't have much. In fact, I think about had as much as Jace had in his pocket, not much more. And I was working at a supplement store like GNC to try to make ends meet. And I met a young man, who was a business guy. And he wanted me to meet his friend, Joe. You have to meet my friend, Joe. And I said, how come? He goes, well, I see you're working this GNC type job. You probably don't want to be doing this much longer. My friend Joe can make you a ton of money. He said he's magic at turning things into the few bucks into tons. He's known for it and people trust him and all this stuff. He says, all you need to do minimum is give him about 5,000 bucks. And he can basically turn your 5,000 into about 25,000 in a few months. Well, I was super tempted because I had 20 bucks to my name and virtually nothing else. And desperate to get going in Okotoks. I was from the Northwest Territories, so, take that for a grain of salt. I never knew what the stock market was, okay? In the stock market. Turns out the guy wanted me to invest in high stocks. He was going to do it through high-risk investments, and it was going to produce high stocks, and that's how I was going to turn my 5,000 into 25,000. So I go to my friend's dad, and I say, listen, look, this awesome opportunity I have. And my friend's dad said to me, Andrew, don't you dare step into that world. He is going to absolutely, you are going to lose everything that you have. You're going to lose that 5,000, which you don't even really have. You'd have to borrow the 5,000 to give him 5,000. You're going to lose everything. Don't you dare. I listened to my friend's advice, but I was angry at him. Remember Solomon's wisdom? It says, wise statements will poke you like a goad. They'll jab you. Well, I was kind of angry at my friend's dad because he just sort of denounced the ability for me to get ahead in Okotoks. A year later, believe it or not, I'm bouncing at the Ranchman's because back then I was big enough to do that. I'm bouncing at the Ranchman's, and lo and behold, Joe and my friend, this guy walks in. It's about a year and a half later after this conversation. And I go up to my friend and I said, yeah, so how's Joe doing? He goes, Andrew, the guy's lost everything. The guy's lost everything. He's down and out. And I just remember going, oh my goodness, thank goodness I listened to my friend's dad. Because his everything would have been my 5,000. Anyway, so just a personal story that I've walked in the, I know what it is to walk on the side of Lady Folly. So what is Proverbs saying? Proverbs is saying, Andrew and Genesis House, and especially you young teenage kids here and those coming into teenage years, the Lord's wisdom to you is be diligent and working at your job, pursue your primary income from work, the trade that you're in, and don't get messed up in quick, rich, fix schemes because they will be fleeting and you'll be on the side of Lady Folly. A commentary I read had a really good one-liner. I love this. Frivolity doesn't fill cupboards. Frivolity does not fill cupboards. Principle number two, Proverbs 21:20, be sure to save. There is precious treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man swallows it up. So, what the proverb is saying is that people who are wise are savers. The people who are foolish are great spenders. So, how do we save? How do we save?
Oh, I just can't get these numbers to add up.
Like we're never going to get out of this hole.
Credit card debt, does it ever end?
Maybe I can help. We sure could use it.
We've tried debt consolidation companies.
We've even taken out loans to help make payments.
Well, you're not the only ones. Did you know millions of Americans live with debt they cannot control? That's why I developed this unique new program for managing your debt. It's called Don't Buy Stuff You Cannot Afford.
Huh. Let me see that. If you don't have any money, you should not buy anything. Sounds interesting.
Sounds confusing.
I don't know, honey. This makes a lot of sense. There's a whole section here on how to buy expensive things using money you save.
Give me that. And where would you get this saved money?
I tell you where and how in chapter 3.
Okay, but what if I want something but I don't have any money?
You don't buy it.
Well, let's say I don't have enough money to buy something. Should I buy it anyway?
No.
Now I'm really confused.
It's a little confusing at first.
Well, what if you have the money? Can you buy something?
Yes.
Now take the money away. Same story?
Nope. You shouldn't buy stuff when you don't have the money.
I think I got it. I buy something I want. And then hope that I can pay for it, right?
No. You make sure you have money, then you buy it.
Oh, then you buy it. But shouldn't you buy it before you have the money?
No.
Why not?
It's in the book. It's only one page long. The advice is priceless, and the book is free.
Wow, I like the sound of that.
Yeah, we can put it on our credit card.
So get out of debt now. Write for your free copy of Don't Buy Stuff You Cannot Afford. And if you order now, you'll also receive Seriously, If You Don't Have the Money, Don't Buy It, along with a 12-month subscription to Stop Buying Stuff magazine. So order today.
Okay, let's move on to the next principle. I mean, honest to goodness, it's hilarious, but it's so true, right? How do we save? We don't buy things that we don't have the money for. I don't think I have this temptation until I go into two stores. One, Costco. Two, Long & McQuaid. All of a sudden, there's food, clothing, and musical sound equipment that I can't stop thinking about and believe that I need in order to be happy and that I deserve it. There's an immediate pull for instant gratification and a sense of entitlement because of how hard I think I've worked. And it doesn't help in our culture that we've been given the means to pay for things that we can't afford. You have credit cards as a way of buying things you can't afford. Lines of credit, and the hardest ones often are the ones that are secured against your home. Ones that are secured against your home, because you can get tens and tens of thousands of dollars, depending on the price of your home. That's sort of free money, but it's not free money because you end up paying for it at a high interest rate. And so again, this is a really critical for us. There's different ways of saving, of course, and all of you will have your sort of favorite ways of going so, but you know, when you pay down your mortgage, you've saved. When you decrease your debts, you've saved. When you make interest on investments, you've saved. When you put things into, say, like a retirement fund, and it'll help you in savings. If you put money in the old-fashioned way in a jar under your bed, or in your yard, dug deep, you've saved. Because all of it seeks to increase like your net worth. So, of course, the secret then is to live within the reality of your means. That requires diligent planning and incredible communication, especially if you're married. Now, I'll just say this as someone who's been a Christian for about 20 years and been part of different church communities, but often in marriages especially, one spouse sort of does it all and one spouse doesn't, and that's okay as long as there's communication between the two of you as to what's happening. Because often breakdown occurs when there's a mismanagement of things and nobody knows what's really going on. And as we know, maybe we don't know, sometimes we think we forget, the amount of money you and I will make will not dictate our ability to save. I'll never forget one of my trainers in my gym. It wasn't Sharon and it wasn't Stuart and it wasn't Callie. The guy was talking about moving on from working in my place. And I understood that, and I knew the reason for him moving on. But one of the things he kept talking about is once he had more money working in the oil patch, how he was going to be able to afford this and that and this and that that he couldn't for working for me. And I said to him, I said, listen, there's a potential for you to earn more, but there's also a great potential for you to not. And he said to me, how come? I said, because right now you can afford a 42-inch TV, but when you work in the oil patch, that will become 65. You might be able to afford only, you know, the shoes at Costco right now for $35. But when you make the money on the oil patch, you'll get Air Jordans for 280. So I said, what's going to happen is you're not necessarily going to save more because you make more, because now the choices that you have because of the income you have are far greater in terms of the kind of things you can buy. So just be aware when you get the new job, which I'm all grateful for you to forgetting, but make sure that it's about diligent planning and about living within the reality of your means as the way you're going to save. So if you and I are living paycheck to paycheck, it's a good indication to tell us that maybe the circumstances that we're in should be re-looked at and reevaluated. There might be some other places that we can seek in our budget to make some savings happen. Principle number three, both parents and grandparents are to save in order to pass down an inheritance. In Proverbs 19:14, it says that house and wealth are an inheritance from fathers. Proverbs 13:22, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, so that's a grandparent, and the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. So here we see wisdom from Solomon that parents and grandparents are to save in order to pass on inheritances through house and wealth. Before we look at this in application, I want to just share with you something really cool that God did for Israel in terms of setting up an inheritance for them as his family. You remember when they came into the land, they took the land of Canaan. When they came into the land of Canaan, he gave them fully paid businesses and homes right off the bat. You're like, how does that work? Well, let's read Jericho 24:13. Oh, I can't do that because it's on my notes, not up there. Joshua 24:13. Yeah, you're up looking at me like funny. Listen to the words from Joshua. So I, the Lord, gave you a land on which you did not toil and cities which you did not build, and you live in them and eat from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. But when they walked in, he gave them cities, which obviously have homes in them, to live in, and he gave them fully functioning agricultural farms and land that they could live off of. So it's really, really neat. He made it so that they didn't have to worry about the economic strain that coming into a new place would cause. At the same time, he didn't expect them to sit idle. He expected them to work. So he says, I'm going to provide you with home. I'm going to provide you with businesses fully paid for. But so you don't just sort of sit back and go, thank you for the five-star inclusive holiday. You are now to make your income from here on in off of working off of the land and any other trade I give you. So any assets that Israelites gained from that day forward came off of work. And that's how they were to live. And I love that because we see this principle now being applied to parents and grandparents. He's encouraging that we can pass on house and wealth, right? Same type of thing as God did for Israel, to our dependent generations below us. He wants us to think wisely about how to do that in order to do that for our kids and grandkids. So there's different ways that you'll approach this. I can't stand up here and give you all the ways in which this can be achieved. But I want to give you a couple thoughts to help you think through what this would require in order to do this. When you and I think of inheritances, we would ask the question, when do these normally get passed down? Now, it's not always the case, but you and I would say typically at death. Again, there's exceptions, but typically at death is when the inheritance comes because that's when the will is read. For house and wealth then to be passed on to dependents below you, that means that you as a parent or grandparent must have saved enough in the working years to have both an investment portfolio and a house paid off. It assumes that, if that's going to be the case. So let's say the person stopped working at 70 and died at 80. Oh, actually, let me say one more thing. That's not true. Never mind. One other aspect about that, not only does it assume that you've saved enough in the working years, let's say a person stopped working at 70 and died at 85. That's 15 years without income in terms of the fullness of working income as when you were in the workforce. That would also mean that you've saved enough in the working years so that in one's retirement, you were not eating away at the savings so as you'd have nothing left when you died. That makes sense? If you only saved enough to get into retirement, but you ate it all up in the next 15 years, there's nothing to pass on. So it assumes that you've saved enough in the working years for your retirement years as well, not just to get to death, if you will. So becoming mortgage free as early as possible will be key, especially at the age when you have to, when you stop working and the finances that you used to bring in are depleted. I know in the Okotoks you see a lot more elderly people having to work, and it has to do with, like, you know, financial decisions that were made in the past. And it's not a statement of judgment, but it's just an unfortunate situation where certain things in life have happened in which that was not able to be done. So to those who are younger as well, who have not maybe got into a home yet, this also helps you understand how God wants you to think. When you're seeking to get into wealth or some kind of financial portfolio or to buy a home, you're going to have to do a lot of planning ahead, knowing that one day God hopes that you will hand that down in wisdom to your children beneath you and the grandchildren as well. So you have to come up with a plan as to the kind of house you're going to buy and the amount that you'll pay for it and what's your plan in terms of having it paid off. So the age of purchase will have a lot to do with maybe the level of home you buy. If you take the average house being a mortgage being around 25 years, it might shape you differently if your first house is purchased at 42 versus at 22. Because at 22 with 25-year mortgage, you're 47 when it's paid off. If you're 42 and buying a new home, now you're 67 and it's being paid off. So again, it might dictate the type of house you might buy depending on your age of purchase. But what if you rent your whole life? What if you rent? Well, then your focus has to be on passing down the inheritance in 1322. You may not pass down a house, but you'll pass down an inheritance. And I would suggest that seek to strive for the equivalent value in money as maybe what you would have had if you had real estate. I asked Jeff to crunch some numbers for me, and this will be really exciting for you to hear this. And Jeff's willing to sit down and maybe do this as a church with us and put this on a spreadsheet and help us walk through this. So I said to him, can you come up with a ratio for me where how many generations would it take if we went God's way with this? How many generations would it take before all of our children and grandchildren would never have to have a mortgage, where their house would be fully paid off and would never have to ever change? When I even say that, you're thinking, is that even possible? By the third or fourth generation, no one in your family would ever have to have a mortgage ever again if they obeyed these principles. And the reason is, but granted, there can't be divorce, because that obviously splits up income. And there can't be, everyone has to obey like the principles of Proverbs just in general. Like, you can't be wise in one area and foolish in every other area, right? But it's basically a person who's willing to go God's way in family. So Jeff came up with a scenario where a husband and wife died at 80 and had a $750,000 home. They divide that home into three segments, and at the child, there's three children, each inherit $250,000. Does that make sense? You die, Your house is worth $750. The parents sell it. The will gets divided amongst three kids. Each gets $250,000. Those three kids take the $250,000 and buy a house with it. Okay? Now, again, it depends on what kind of house you buy and stuff as well. But this is work with the numbers and basic level. By the third generation, that $250,000 that was passed down is now $980,000, just under $1 million. And there was four kids in that family, and each got $980,000. So four kids getting $1 million in the third generation. What kind of house do they need? They don't need a $1 million home. They could buy a $600,000 home and have $400,000 left over. And that now becomes just liquid. They can invest that at 5% or 4% in GICs even. Can you imagine the return of $4 million year after year after year? By the third to fourth generation, every single person could have no mortgage. And here's the cool thing. Some of you are grandparents in you here. So you're first generation. You have kids, they're second generation. That means some of your children sitting here today could be debt, have no mortgage by the third generation if we go God's way. You read that and think, oh, that's just basic. It's not basic. And I'm not criticizing anybody because I'm in the same boat, just so you know. Like, I'm in the same boat as you. But here's what I learned through this. Why aren't we in this situation? Because through our generations of history of family, we haven't embraced this and our families haven't done this. Right? And so now that's why we're carrying the debt we have on our mortgages and stuff. But we could make a stake in the ground today in this church and say, we will be the first generation to start a new trend in Genesis House for how this could look. And I'm giving you this, the basic numbers. Jeff gave me a whole Excel spreadsheet, and we can go through it as a church. But if you're interested in this, please talk to him and myself, and we'll make something happen here. And we can take your actual numbers and see how we can move forward in financial planning. So, again, these are principles, not rules, right? Can I give you a principle or a new thought that I've never had before until this week? And you can say, I'm not going to do that, Andrew. And I'm like, that's fine. But if you want to consider this, learning from what God did with Israel, God didn't provide Israel with a passive income. When they came into the land, he didn't say, here's $100,000 for each of you. He said, here's a home and here's a paid-for business. Now you learn to work, and everything you earn from here on in, honor me with your wealth. Okay? What if we did that for our children in some kind of way, where instead of giving cash to our kids and put money directly towards their, certain things in life, what if we were to say, I tell you what, kids, we'll put our money directly towards a home. Or we'll help you get started in business. So we're not going to give you like cash. We're going to put a large amount of our money into a business to get you working and into a home to get you started. And then that way, they then, as children, learn to work the way God intended. And everything they earn, they can then choose how they want to use that money. So again, it's just a thought. I'm not telling you have to do that. But it's just something interesting to think about. And we'll finish with this one. I've got two more, but I think one more is enough. Regarding inheritances, they need to be passed down slowly. Proverbs 20:21, an inheritance gained hurriedly at the beginning will not be blessed in the end. We all probably have stories of people that have received large inheritances very quickly in cash amounts and so on and have burned through them. I remember about 14, 15 years ago, I was asked to give my testimony at the Evangelical Free Church in town. And big part of my testimony is how I was horrendously in debt with Janice and how the Lord, through his wisdom, got us out of debt by following his Proverbs principles. And I told the church my whole story. And at the end of my testimony, a family came up to me and said, can we talk to you? And I said, sure. And we sat down, and I said, they said, well, how did you get out of debt? So I walked them through the Proverbs principles and showed them everything. And then this one here was the number one that was broken that led to their debt. It was one of the number one things. What happened was they had moved from another community to Okotoks, and their parents gave them an early inheritance. They gave them the full inheritance right away before they died in a cash amount. They gave them $50,000. The husband and wife spent the entire $50,000 in about 12 to 18 months. And I asked them, what'd you spend it on? They said, we went on holidays, we bought new vehicles, we bought this, we bought that. It was all material things. The problem was that attitude towards money and spending never stopped when the $50,000 was gone. Their heart was still in the same place in terms of how they viewed money. And when I met them, they were tens of thousands of dollars in the hole. And when we read this, it cut them to the heart because they recognized that, their parents should not have given them $50,000 up front, probably knowing their lifestyle. Which was a recommendation too, I think, from Proverbs, is how do we determine what is slow and in what amounts? Well, again, that's going to be up to you to judge the character of your children and your grandchildren. And look at them and say, you know, how have they handled money in their teenage years? How have they handled money in their early 20s? How do they approach life in general with work and so on and so forth? So that's up to you as parents. But the principle still is don't give all to them all at once. Lord, I just give you thanks for your word. And like always, you stimulate thought. You stimulate emotions in us that we have to process. And all of that's good because your Holy Spirit is one that's sharper than a double-edged sword. And so we know that you are trying to invoke change in us, both in our thought life and in the way we practically live it out. And I love what Dave said, like, it's not here to condemn us, Lord. It's here to just do a real personal self-reflection in the mirror to say, where am I at with my heart in relation to money and wealth? So I pray, God, that you use your word to bear fruit. And I pray, Lord, that just like we look back in life and we remember, you know, certain years and certain historical moments when someone put a stake in the ground that made long-lasting change, that even today that we would make long-lasting change in what the Christian community can look like in terms of homes and wealth. That going forward now, Lord, that our grandchildren can look back and go, wow, like, this is amazing, like, God's been so good to us. And so, Lord, I look forward to what you're going to do in and amongst our church. And again, we hold on to the wealth lightly because we know you're the provider of it and you're the giver of it. And we just want to use it for your kingdom's purposes and not for selfish means. So, yeah, we look forward to what you're going to do and how you're going to change us. In Christ's name, amen. Thanks, Sammy.